Welcome to the Julia and Gino podcast, where business meets family. We explore what the entrepreneurial life looks like from a family perspective. We are your hosts, Julia and Gino Barbaro. Hey everyone, this is Julia Barbaro, host of the Julia and Gino podcast. I am here with the co-founder of Jake and Gino, my husband and co-host, Gino Barbaro.
Julia, this is going to be a fun podcast because we're going to be talking about money. A little bit less about the family, a little bit more about the
money.
It
will go family, you'll see.
Today's guest is Luke Holman. He's the author of 4 books, numerous articles, and cited as an inventor on more than a dozen patents. Luke is an internationally recognized expert in agile software development. He organized the first Agile conference in 2003, so he's an old timer like me. He served on the board of Agile Alliance and in partnership with the Scrum Alliance produced the collaboration at Scale, the world's largest monthly webinar devoted to helping organizations with 10 or more Scrum teams in 2 or more locations scale agility. Founder and CEO of First Root Inc., his mission is to create the next generation of impact investor and get $1,000 into 1 million schools globally and watch what happens when youth control $1 billion in capital. Welcome to the show, Luke.
Hi, everyone. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, we're happy that you're here.
So let's just dive into that mission. 1K, 1M, 1B. That's what you said to me. So how did that come up?
Well, I am a fan of Jim Collins's work in Good to Great and Built to Last. And he talks about how all of us yearn for an inspiring mission and objective, something bigger than ourselves that when we accomplish is actually creating just a little better world. And aligned with our company mission of teaching financial literacy and promoting civic engagement, we decided that there's 100,000 schools in America and there's roughly 4 million schools around the world. 17% of the world's population is in K-12 education. So we picked the numbers that sounded fun and easy, 1K, 1M, 1B. And what I like about that big, hairy, audacious goal or BHAG is that it actually forces our company into a few choices. One is we think globally about our software. So we want to be inclusive. We think about scale. So we're building something that's secure and safe for our children and our families who are using our software. We're building something that can be adapted to a given context or a given culture. What kids need in Topeka, Kansas are very different than what kids need in Philadelphia, which are very different than what kids need in Tel Aviv. But the same process can be used to put money in the hands of kids and help them learn financial literacy, but also help them improve their schools and their communities.
Luke, would you say this has become your vocation?
Yeah, I have been working in the field of participatory budgeting and collaborative decision-making for more than 20 years. And that's been the topic of some of my books. So I do believe it's my calling, it's my purpose, it's my vocation. And I feel very happy that I discovered that because it's a joy to get out of bed and work. I laugh. So one night we're having some friends over for dinner and I said to the other husbands, I'm like, does your wife like kind of like hit you in the middle of the night while you're sleeping? And I'm like, yeah, I'll be like sleeping. And then suddenly I get this whack. I'm like, what did I do? And then Jenna says, honey, I'm not hitting you. And she looks at her friends and she says, I'm checking if he's still in bed because he'll go to bed and then he'll wait until I fall asleep. And then he slips out of bed to go back to work. And he thinks he doesn't know. I'm like, I didn't know you knew. She's like, I know. And so that's how you feel when you have your vocation, right? You're just so excited to do this.
And that's important. We were at mass last night and I had a deacon speaking and he was actually older. He's going to the seminary, gray beard. And he said something to me that was profound. He actually said very simple. He goes, I've been going through life. I was in the military for 6 years. I was in my business for 20 years, paying the bills. It seemed like I was materially, you know, wealthy and I was doing really well on the outside, but there was something missing in my heart that I wasn't going towards my true vocation to what God was calling me. And to him, it was actually a calling to the priesthood. So it's amazing that you're going towards your vocation. I think Julia and myself, with this podcast, with Jake and Gino, we found our vocation, at least in the business world. We've always had the family vocation, but this is something to bring around with the family and an amazing way to make money doing something that you love to do in your vocation. How long did it take you to figure that out? How long did it take you to find your calling or your vocation?
I don't know if it, in a sense, doesn't matter. Like the goal is to find it, but I don't feel like it took me that long to find my vocation because a couple of things. One, when I was 17 and I was making some choices about how I wanted to, because when you're 17, you're making choices like, what do I want to do after school, after high school, et cetera. I read this amazing article by a woman, Annie Dillard, called Living Like a Weasel, Living Like Weasels. And in this really beautifully written article, she describes, she was outside going for a walk and she saw a weasel attack its prey. And a weasel will go for the jugular of their prey. But what's curious about a weasel is they have a tendon in their jaw that they can't unlock unless the prey dies or the weasel dies. Right. So the weasel, like they found weasel skulls on bear paws and like weasel skulls in eagles. And it's like, oops, you grabbed onto the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. And in her article, she makes this kind of challenge to people. She's like, could you live like a weasel? Could you find that one thing and bite into its neck and just hold on for dear life? And of course, you're 17 and you're like, yeah, I can live that way. And the way that expressed itself for me was I was making a choice at the time about my athletic background. So I'm a former United States national champion in pairs figure skating. And I was on the international team for the United States for a few years. But when I was 17 and a junior in high school, I wasn't that good yet, but I was starting to get good because guys mature a little older in pair skating because you got to be strong enough to pick up the girl and toss her around and that kind of stuff. But I was starting to get good and I had this choice to make. Do I go to school or do I go to skating? And my mom supported me in that choice. And I said, look, I can only skate when I'm young. So I want to live like a weasel about skating. And then I've kind of lived like a weasel ever since. And so what's really cool about it is what I find is that when you bite into the right thing, you know it because it bites you back. Mm-hmm. And then you're on the ride. And so the notion of a vocation, which I do think can change, right? I mean, I skated a long time ago. Now I'm doing other things. You can change and you can have, in a sense, multiple vocations. This, your deacon was in the military. And I'm sure in that time frame, they were very committed to service for our country. And then they ran their business. Mm-hmm. So the point isn't that it's a vocation for your life as if it will never change. It's that when you make that commitment, man, you bite in and you hang on.
Yeah. You know, I have to say it's interesting. What you say is so true. You know, when I actually got out of high school, what I wanted is what I got is a stay-at-home mom, to be married, to raise my family. And it's interesting how the seasons change because now all of a sudden I'm working with this guy in a different way. You know, 20 years ago, I would have laughed hysterically if you said I was going to be on a podcast talking about financial education and how ridiculous that would be. And so our journey in life, you know, we have absolutely no idea where we're going to go. And it's very mysterious sometimes, but it's incredible to watch and look back to see where you were, what you wanted, and where you are now. It's amazing. But I wanted to talk about a little bit about that, you know, the financial education as far as the youth and the young people. And tell us a little bit about your thoughts on that.
Sure. So part of what I'm doing with youth is informed, obviously, by my prior experience in business. My last company was Contenio, and it was an enterprise software company devoted to helping businesses make budgeting decisions or portfolio decisions. So most businesses have an absolute garbage process for making their portfolio management decisions. They take their end of, at the end of the year, getting ready for next year, they have a budget. And of course, the request for the budget spend always exceeds the available budget, right? Because human imagination is unbounded and human resources are finite.
Did you hear that, Julia? Hold on a second.
I actually
write that down. Okay. Because your imagination is unbounded, okay. Baby. But unbounded. The resources sometimes are limited. You know what I'm saying?
So resources are limited, right? Right. And successful life in business and in family. And we'll talk about the family side in a bit, but successful businesses learn to live within their means, right? We're not the government. We don't print money, which is a separate topic, but we learn to live within our means. But how do you make that decision? And what I looked at was most people hate the decision-making process around budgeting in business. You're supposed to collaborate with your peers, except at the end of the year when you fight like Hunger Games over the budget. So what I did was I invented collaborative ways to manage the budget, which is very simple. So let's say your budget is $20 million. And let's say the budget request for your marketing or your business as a whole is $25 million. Well, you got to figure out how to make that work. Well, what we do is we put, let's say, 5 decision makers in the room, and we give each of them an equal portion of the budget. So each of the 5 decision makers now has $4 million of virtual money, monopoly money, whatever. And we list all of the potential spending initiatives, and we say, here's the rules of the game. You can fund whatever you want, but for the initiative to be fully funded, for the initiative to be engaged, it has to be fully funded. And if you don't have enough money to fund it, you have to convince other people to join you. So let's say there's 2 initiatives that you want to fund, and collectively the 2 initiatives are $5 million and you only have $4 million. Well, now you've created something that's competitive and you've started to make it collaborative. You want to bring people into your position, and now you're talking about the positive actions. And this technique, this process, is known as participatory budgeting. And in my last company, I did it in person, and I built a software platform to support companies doing this. And we had wonderful adoption. We had BMW and Cisco and Salesforce and eBay and Google and all these big companies, Daimler, managing hundreds of millions of dollars of budget and loving it because we took something that was competitive and made it collaborative. Now, along the way, I was on a plane ride and I was sitting next to the head of economic development for the city of San Jose, Kim Willesh, about a decade ago. And she started telling me about how the city was in debt because of the recession and they didn't know how to make budget choices and budget cuts. And I'm like, out of the blue, I just blurted out, I do this for businesses and I'll do it for the city and I'll do it for free. And I believe that we all need to be somehow philanthropic or civically engaged, and we have the civic responsibilities and duties and we can contribute. And this is my calling, my vocation. And I said, look, I know how to do this stuff. Let me do it for the city. And he said, really? I'm like, yeah. So we did the same thing for the city. We assembled hundreds of citizens in San Jose and we gave them elements of the budget to make decisions about. And it was a huge success. So now I'm doing this philanthropically. I tell my kids, you know, those who marry for money earn it. So you can't do everything in life because you're paid, right? And then a few years later, I was sitting at dinner and we're having family dinner. And I said, hey, I got an idea. And of course, everyone laughs. I'm like, oh, dad's got an idea. Mm-hmm. I said, let's do it at the school. And then it goes quiet. My wife is like, what? I'm like, let's give the kids money and trust that they'll make a good choice and support them in this process. She's like, oh, honey, come on, really? And I'm like, let's try it. I said, Cress, who was my second son, he was in 8th grade at the time. I said, Cress, give me one idea to make the school better. Dad, that's easy. We need a second lunch line. Why? Well, because kids like me who bring our lunch, all we want is a drink, but I get stuck in the same line as the kids who actually want the food. If there was a separate line for just drinks, I could get my drink and we could go out and play more. Operational engineering, and it would make the school better. So we did it. I convinced the other parents to do this. And the reason it was easy is because I wrote the check. So I wrote this, you know, a check for $500 for a middle school. And we took our software platform that was built for businesses and we used it as is for the school. And the kids created almost 500 ideas. So there's a very structured process to go through this, right? You go to the kids and you say, identify ways to improve the school. Then you create ideas. Then you shape those ideas, which is where the financial literacy comes in. Then you vote on those ideas and then we implement it. So we took the school through that entire process and they ended up buying an LK water bottle refilling station to replace the water fountain so they could be more green. And I got hooked on that. That was my new thing to latch into. And so I worked on my company that I was in. I sold it, completed my integration tasks, and started First Root because we have 2 massive problems in our society right now. Our children are not financially literate, which means they can make choices that can harm them for their entire life. And they're not being taught positive civic engagement. And what they're seeing is polarization in our country that is starting to put cracks in the foundation of our democracy itself. And so participatory budgeting in schools has this magical quality of providing a direct lived experience about how to manage a budget and a positive civic engagement experience.
See, unfortunately, our parents weren't taught financial intelligence either, but there was nothing in that society 50, 60, 100 years ago, such as credit cards, such as the instant gratification, such as you're talking about Amazon. I mean, it's the way, I mean, my mom's mortgage back in 1978 was $150 a month. My cell phone bill is more than what her mortgage payment was. So there was one car, there was less to be able to purchase. We've gone from a producer society to a consumer society. And the first thing we need to teach our children is you should think about producing. And then when you produce, you can consume. But it's the reverse way around nowadays. And with credit cards, it's so simple. So when you were less financially intelligent back in the day, you were more of a saver and less of a spender. When you flip that, if you don't have the financial intelligence, you're going down the road. And, you know, Jake and Gino, we say people with financial intelligence can change the world for the better. And you're living proof of it. And I think our company's living proof of it. Where do we start teaching our kids? What are the foundational pillars that you like to talk about when we're discussing financial intelligence? And I can share a couple of mine after you've shared a couple of yours.
Yeah, I think it's really important for, before we answer that question, is to really, really celebrate what you said, Gino. I think it's really important for me personally. We're not here to make the past wrong, because the past wasn't wrong. What we are here to say is the level of complexity that our society has created is dramatically different than what our parents or our parents' parents dealt with. I really like the way you said it. I really want to celebrate what you said. You didn't say, oh, my parents weren't taught that and they were wrong. What you said was my parents weren't taught that and they lived in a vastly different context and a vastly different life. And I think that is so important for people to realize that the way you said it was inclusive. It wasn't judgmental. It wasn't making anyone wrong. And you recognize how different things are. And look at what we've created now. Now our kids are not only dealing with credit cards, they're dealing with 38 kinds of credit cards. They're not dealing with a mortgage. They're dealing with 17 kinds of mortgages. They're not dealing with life insurance. They're dealing with a whole complex range of life insurance, some of which are very deleterious in terms of their outcomes, because term life insurance is too simple. Well, actually, it's pretty good. And now, where are we? We've got crypto. We've got a gamified and addictive applications that are psychologically addictive, because we've figured out how to create addictive social media. So now we've applied that to finance, and we have apps that are addictive about financial choices, like selling and trading stocks. So I really appreciate what you just said. And now let's talk about how we teach financial literacy. When we look at things that we want to teach, I find it helpful to distinguish between technical skills and life skills. So chemistry is a technical skill. Algebra is a technical skill. Technical skills are really about the technical side of thinking, right? There are rules to algebra. There are rules to chemistry. There's a definition. A mole is a mole, right? And the chemical reaction really doesn't care how you feel. A chemical reaction doesn't, you know, algebra doesn't care how you feel. That's algebra, right?
It's the truth. It's not my truth or your truth. It's just the truth. It's exactly it's the what truth. Happens. Yes.
Agreed. Now, life skills are very different. And so life skills have three components. There is knowledge, and that's the facts. So let's think about financial literacy in the sense of knowledge. Well, I need to know what a stock is. It's a share of ownership of a company. I need to know what a bond is. It's a kind of loan. That's a fact. Then there's a skill. Just like in math and chemistry, there's a skill. I can balance an algebraic equation, or I can understand a chemical reaction. And as the skill associated with financial literacy is I can compare two stocks to determine which is an appropriate investment, or I can compare two credit card offers and I can understand which has the lower interest rate or the lower annual fee. But the third component of a life skill is disposition. What is your personality? Who are you as a person? What do you value? Are you more risk averse? Or are you more risk tolerant? Do you like making money and spending money? Or do you not really like spending money? So I've got four kids and you have six, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
It's both a lot. We have a lot of kids, both of us.
Yeah, we have a lot of kids.
One is a lot.
A lot of emotions like, running around is what she's saying.
Five girls, so there is a lot of emotions.
All right. So in my four kids, right, one of them, my youngest, she's in a sense amazing. She's 16. She's got three jobs right now, right? She teaches swim lessons. She works at Safari Run, which is this kind of local thing. And she walks dogs because she loves dogs, and I'm not going to get a dog. And she wants to be with dogs. I'm like, look, you want to watch it? If you want to be with a dog, get a job walking, you know, get a job walking dogs. She's like, fine, I will. Like, and she did.
Great idea.
So she makes money. And of all my kids, guess what? She spends it. Mm-hmm. And that's fine because she does have a plan for how she manages her money. Now, my other kids make money and they don't really like shopping very much. And so, yeah, they have jobs. Right? One kid works at Starbucks and whatever, but they don't like to spend money. And that's just their disposition. It's not right or wrong. It's just who they are as people. And I think that when we look at building a life skill, we have to recognize that the main difference in a technical skill versus a life skill is the inclusion of activities that help you understand yourself. How do I feel about money? What do I value about money? How do I want to behave about money? And that's partly being comfortable as a parent so that you can share those experiences, but it's just recognizing that pedagogically, how we teach these life skills is very different.
It's amazing that you're saying that because we have something called a personal finance academy that we've created. And the first thing we start off with is what can parents do? So it's not only upon the children, we're gearing it towards young adults. What can parents do? Well, you got to talk, you walk the walk. If you're telling your kids to save money, be responsible and have a budget, but you're not doing it, shame on you, parents. The other thing is the next part we go into, the next week we get into is skills that they need to learn. There's a lot of different life skills they need to learn as far as instant gratification, as far as being on time, all of those skills. And then we get into money, the banking system, finance. We even go into insurance, we go into credit scores, we go into taxes, all of this other stuff. But if you don't get into the first couple of parts, we even have a personal development area where we talk about values, values-based decision-making. We talk about coaching. We talk about, you know, setting goals. These are all things that not even taught in college. I had to go out and become a life coach to learn a lot of these skills. So I think I'd love for the children to learn about that. And that's what you're talking about, disposition. It's really the personal development aspect of it and find out who you are, find out your values. If your value is to go to work and enjoy that money, great. If your value is to go to work, save that money for a rainy day, great. Understand who and what you are. Stocks may not be right for you. I may want to buy a house and house hack that house. So I think we're on the same wavelength.
You are. And I looked at your material and I was struck by how much I enjoyed the fact that quite naturally you included all three components in your teaching. So I did my homework. I'm like, oh, okay. They have a thing. Now, what does it say? Oh, it talks about this dispositional aspects and you, by helping people understand themselves, what is my goal? Doesn't have to be the same. I mean, the idea that you hear this a lot in the financial podcast is like, they always say like, where do you want to travel? Well, what if you don't want to travel? What if your goal is philanthropy? Or what
I don't have a bucket list. I agree with you. Like, what's my bucket list? I've done everything I want to do. I totally agree with that. Like, there is no bucket list. What are we doing today? And I agree with you 100%.
And by the way, here's the interesting thing is and you're not making someone wrong when they do have a bucket list.
Yes.
And that's a really important point of that disposition. We have some really good neighbors, like four houses down. We've been friends with them. Jenna's known them pre-marriage. We've been friends with them for 25 years, right? Man, we love going to their house for dinner because they serve good wine. Like wine I would never buy,
That's right?
And you can look at that. If you look at it on the outside, you could judge them. You could say, oh, well, you know, they spend a lot of money on wine. What's going on? Well, their financial choice was informed by their life choice. They decided not to have kids. Mm-hmm. And they decided that what they love isn't travel, isn't faster, fancy cars. They're foodies. They mm-hmm. love their wine. And I'm glad they love their wine because I love going to their house and drinking their wine.
That's right.
But the point is we don't judge. Right. And that's part of this notion of we want to understand mm-hmm. ourselves.
I do want to touch that a little bit, because even as a parent, even as a parent, you know, when we have six kids, you have four kids, or people out there with 10 kids that I know that are listening to this podcast. Oh my gosh. We have to look at that child, and especially when they grow up, as a unique person that have a different value system that you do. They have different disposition, like you mentioned. And it's hard as a parent to say, well, don't you want this? And tell them what it should be, instead of let them be their own person. You know, even as a married couple, we are very different. You know, he loves cars. I look for comfort and visibility. And that is my favorite part of a car. If I can see around and it is comfortable to sit in, I am super happy. But that's the beauty of everyone and every individual, is that they're so unique. And we don't really teach that in schools, because it's about math, science, English, and history.
Well, why would you?
That's right.
Try and optimize for that. And that's one of the challenges. Now, I'm going to really push you all a little bit, because I know that you do homeschooling. And I want to talk about something that I think is one of the hidden language challenges that we face. One of the things that you said, Gino, and I said too, is this notion of personal financial literacy, right? Mm-hmm. But here's the paradox. There is no decision in finance that matters that is made individually. And when we think of personal and we equate it with individual, we make real mistakes. And what I mean by that is, contrary to the commercial from Lexus, there's no way I would buy a new car without talking to my wife. I'm not going to, like, hey, hon, walk outside and there's a new car with a bow on it. Because she would know that bow would be for me, not for her. But when you think about everything in life, the thing that we're missing, and this actually deals with the civic engagement and how we are as people with each other in communities, is Jake and Gino, you wouldn't make a major financial decision in your company without talking with your partners and your VPs and your directors. You wouldn't buy stock in a new startup without talking to a financial advisor. You wouldn't buy a vacation home now that your kids are older without at least including them. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that's really important is we have to remember that material financial decisions are never made in isolation. And by teaching the technique of participatory budgeting, we make better outcomes. And so we actually are working on versions of our software for families. Mm-hmm. And what we did was we created this big matrix. What are things that I want to teach my kids that are important about life skills with money? And what are decisions that we could make as a family that would let me teach those life skills? So examples of things I want to teach my kids are things like a difference between a capital expense and an operating expense. Like, buying windows is very different than buying a car, because both have a capital component, but a car has an operating component. Windows really don't have an operational expense once you upgrade them, or a new door or new flooring, for example. What about total cost of ownership? How do I really understand the complete cost of something? And then we looked at activities that you can do with your kids. So we picked three: planning a family vacation, planning a home improvement, and planning charitable donations. And I remember when I was a kid, I felt kind of frustrated, because I know I'm supposed to tithe, but how come I didn't get a choice in where that money went? Mm-hmm. So now you can, in that matrix, you have this really rich opportunity to work with your children. So when the kids say, hey, let's go to Disney, the tickets are $80. You can say, or $100 or whatever they are, you can say, well, wait a minute, mom and dad don't think about Disney by the cost of the tickets, because we're going to add in the cost of the travel, the cost of the hotel, the cost of the food, the cost of the souvenir, plus the cost of the rides that the tickets don't pay for. Oh, and you want to go in the fast pass line, that's an additional surcharge. So the total cost of ownership is, or with charitable donations, the way my wife and I work it is, we kind of set the budget, and then we get the kids to help us decide how to allocate the budget in the charitable donations. And now we get to ask a different set of questions. Hey, you want to give money to that charity again? How do you know you should? How did they perform? Did they align with your goals and your expectations and your values? And are they still aligned? Is that how you still feel about something? And so there's these really wonderful opportunities. And that's going back to the goal of creating impact investors. If you want to make a change in the world, you have to have two things: the means and the mindset. Well, the means are our times, our talents, and our treasure. And the mindset is, I actually want to do this. And so by putting those things together, the family units can actually create that foundation.
Mm-hmm. I love that. That's amazing.
She's trying to pull it back into the family. But I'm gonna keep it as a business.
Well, he was talking about
realm.
Family. Okay. If you were listening, talking about family, and I think that foundation is so crucial, because a lot of times we think as a couple, we make the decisions and we're going to let our kids know what they are. And one of our major decisions was when we left New York to move to Florida, and we took our 6 kids along with us, but it had to be a conversation where they understood the reason. And that was a really hard conversation. There were 6 of them. They all had different reactions. I was surprised by some of them, but it has to be, you know, every decision that we make personally affects everyone else, whether we believe it or not, it does. Every decision that I make affects my husband, my children, and who knows how many other people that I'm not aware of. But the financial part of it, the family should be involved, whether they have an absolute say or not, but they should understand the reason behind it, as you were saying. So I appreciate that you said that.
There's a couple of things I need to mention as to what you were talking about, Luke. First thing is, we need to avoid the groupthink. That's what's going on right now in this country. Social media does a fantastic job of that, where you know, liberals are speaking to liberals and conservatives are speaking to conservatives, mm-hmm. and there's no crossover. And it's just amazing what happens. You get, forget me, polarity, you just get no thought. You get no creativity going on, because it's just everyone's agreeing with each other. And it's like, okay. The other thing is, it's called personal financial engineering. That's what we talk about with mm-hmm. that. You want to engineer your life personally, which I think is really important. And for all you parents out there, very simple technique on how to teach kids the value of money, because money is really inanimate. It's so plentiful. But when you're a 15-year-old and you're making $10 an hour at the store, and you need to go buy this chair that costs you $100, that chair is going to cost you 10 hours of your life. Does your child want to spend the next 10 hours of their life making money to buy for that chair? That's how you can start packing it down. As an adult, you can do the same thing. If you're buying a car for $20,000 and you're making $100 an hour, you do the math. Is it worth it? That's how you do it. And I think one other important thing you should teach your children, it's always price versus value. What does something cost versus what is the value of it? If you're buying something that's going to last a year and it costs you $10, the cost and the value is $10. But if it's cost you $20, but it lasts you 5 years, you can see the big difference in it. There's more value in that object. So I think we have the consumer mindset, as most of us, but when you have that investor mindset and you look at value towards something, that's something that you should teach your children.
Well, one of the things, in order to teach our children the proper way of the financial world, is we have to understand it first. Or find a company that can teach it to everyone at the same time, just like Luke was talking about. Because a lot of times, you know, especially we were talking about budget earlier, a lot of us shy away from that and we avoid it because we don't understand it. And so how are we going to teach our children about budgeting if we are terrible at it? Because they're going to just learn by our example and they're going to just follow along. My husband was he's a super smart guy and he's very educated, and he always, you know, Amazon would always come to the house. So he's always learning. But one of the things he's really good at is budgeting, you know, and we talked about his parents before that. He didn't follow his parents' footsteps. He's learned a new way. And a lot of us as parents don't do that. And that I'm noticing, Luke, that's what you're trying to help.
Yeah. To unpack there, right? One of the things that you did in that example is you help translate something that's abstract, money, into something that's concrete, which is time, mm-hmm. which helps pedagogically and teaching our children. But this notion of teaching children, one of the things that it's hard for kids to understand, especially when they're young, is the magnitude of money. Mm-hmm. So when we go into schools, I want to highlight a few things, because we haven't answered them and I don't want people to guess. So the first question that I often get is, well, how much money do you actually give the kids in a school? And I have a funny answer for that, but it's really important. We give enough money to be meaningful to the kids, but not so much money that the parents will come in and take over.
More than a little and less than too much.
Right.
I got it.
Thank you. And yes. Now the actual number is usually about $2,000 to $10,000. And that scales a little bit by whether it's an elementary school or a middle school or a high school. So my targets are 2,000 for elementary schools, 5,000 for middle schools, and 10,000 for high schools. And if you think about a high school, it's really not a lot of money, but it is enough money for the kids to do something. But what we're also doing, and this is something that is hard for kids to grasp, is until they start to actually manage their own money, and many kids don't have the opportunity to do that, they may or may not have allowances. I grew up really poor. My mom and dad had 6 kids, but my dad died when I was 4. My mom raised 6 kids on her own. And she was a school teacher, and more than once she lost her job. So we were the family that you gave the turkey to, and we were very happy that you did. So we didn't have money to manage. right? I didn't have, my friends were like getting allowances. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Or they'd get a job. And I'm like, yeah, I got a job. And it goes right to the family because we need everyone working to mm-hmm. survive. So by doing this through schools, for the kids who don't have the same economic background or the same opportunity, we give them an experience of the magnitude of money. And like we did a project with an elementary school in Madison, Wisconsin. And it was really cute because the kids are like, we have a $1,500. Let's get a new baseball field. And you're like, okay, you're not going to get a new baseball field for $1,500. But we're having a conversation about what you brought up, the magnitude of money. And what you did in that example of hours of work was you were able to give the kids an experience in a way to look at magnitude that they could understand. We are trying to do the same thing in schools for kids who may not have that option of I don't have money to manage. Mm-hmm. How do I understand how to manage money? And I also want to key on price versus value. Okay. If you go into my garage and you look at my Sawzall, you're going to go, dude, that's a well-used Sawzall. And if you look at my circular saw, you're going to be like, dude, I think it's dusty. So meaning I've got some financial choices I've made that haven't worked out so well. So how do you deal with failure? Because I have not been perfect in managing money. I've made some mistakes. And so we worked with one school where the kids bought a 3D printer. And I really want to key on this notion that you brought up about value. They decided to get the cheapest 3D printer they had so they could get another item, right? Because the budget is a bucket and you can get, mm-hmm. well, of course, the printer broke after 2 months. Mm-hmm. And what was wonderful about that experience is that teacher did not make those kids wrong. That school had a conversation about what is value and when should you buy value. And frankly, I'd rather have the kids make a mistake like that on a few $100 purchase in the context of people who can help them reason and understand what that mistake was about than making that mistake when they're in college and they signed an apartment lease that they couldn't afford, or they bought a new car when they should have bought a used car. Or any number of other choices. I want them to be able, if they have a failure experience, to have failure experiences that don't permanently harm them and have this opportunity to talk about that experience. I think that's so important when you look at the value. And in our lesson plans, Gina, we talk about the fact that when you're making choices about value, you want to look at your life. And we see mistakes being made, like poorer people often will buy fancy sneakers and poor work boots, when they should be buying great work boots and cheap sneakers, right? Like, where are you putting the money relative to your individual need? So I really love the fact that you brought up this notion of price versus value, because we all have made mistakes on price versus value equations. I know I have.
I'm a big Zig Ziglar fan. So Zig talks about that a lot. He talks
sometimes
about
you
it
have
often
to go through it
with his bikes. Yeah, yeah, it's one of those things. Mm-hmm. We could be talking about this for hours and hours and hours. This is, you know, I want to wrap the show up, but really important. Luke, how do the listeners get a hold of you? How does the next school contact you and say, hey, I love what I'm hearing. How do I get involved?
Yeah, go to firstroot.co and fill out the form that they want to get involved, or connect to me on LinkedIn, or send me an email at luke.homan@firstroot.co. I'm actually not hard to find on the internet.
I like that. Any final words before we sign off?
I just appreciate you for allowing me to share this story with you and your listeners. I feel blessed to have met you, because there's this huge set of people who care about the things that we care about. And we may not be as vocal as some of the people who are shouting on social media, but I think we're making a difference.
I appreciate that. I thank you for being on as well. For me, it's one of these subjects that I'm going to say it again, people with financial intelligence, we can change the world for the better. We can use our assets. We can empower ourselves to direct the money to where we want it to go. If we don't know where we want it to go, I think we're doing a disservice to ourselves.
Yeah, and Luke, I just want to thank you for putting all the time and effort and, you know, for getting up in the middle of the night and having your great ideas, because this is what it becomes of it, because we need this. We really do. And a lot of us, we just put it aside because we don't understand.
Luke, you've just saved me, because I'm working on Memorial Day and she's like, you're working. See, so now I can say I'm getting up and I'm working because I'm making change.
And I hope your wife continues to, you know, smack you. I will continue to push my husband over.
You know, wouldn't want to have it any other way. One day,
because obviously we're very alike.
Thanks, Luke. We appreciate it.
Thank you.